Welcome to It's All Recruiting, the show that looks at everything through the lens of recruiting. I'm your host, Jim Stroud.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, welcome to another exciting, action-packed episode of It's All Recruiting with your host, with the most, Jim Stroud, yours truly. How are you? It's been a while since we've had one of these podcasts. I know. I've been traveling, been hanging out at SourceCon, been hanging out at Source and Summit Europe, hanging out with all the cool kids, like one of my guests here today, Chad Sowash, who heads up our veteran recruiting here at Ranchside Sourceright. How are you, Chad?
Wonderful. I love being pulled into the cool kid bucket.
Well, you are one of the cool kids. Thank you so much for hanging out with me. Of all the sourcing talks and presentations I've experienced these past couple weeks, there was something I thought was conspicuously absent, and that is military recruiting. I didn't really see a lot of it out there, none of the conferences that I was at. Do you tend to see recruiting conferences, military recruiting discussed at corporate conferences?
Just general recruiting conferences, mainly because recruiters, they don't know what they don't know. It's still kind of mystic, you know, it's somewhat magic.
Yeah. I had heard, I don't know if it was you or someone else was telling me how when you become a military recruiter, you go through all this training and rigmarole and to really do what they do, and no one really knows what's that about. I mean, could you say anything about that?
Yeah, no, it's amazing. I mean, when you're in the military and you get a position, like I was a drill sergeant, you know, and you have to go through a school, and we're talking about weeks and months, put it that way, months of schooling, and that's your job. I mean, you have to go through, I mean, you're talking about easily 40 hours a week with homework, assignments, pass or fail tests, and then you graduate from a school. But I mean, that was in drill sergeant school. Recruiting school, much different. But I know a little bit about that, but I do have a guy who does know. Give me a second, Jim. I'm gonna get.
Yeah.
Hey, Dennis. I got Dennis Carpenter here. He was actually a U.S. Army recruiter. And he can tell you more about the school and a lot of the stuff that actually goes on there.
Oh,
what's
that's
up, Dennis?
Convenient.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for having me.
Hello, sir.
To elaborate with what Chad just said, Army Recruiting School is also a couple of months long. You know, we're looking at least 56 days. Now, you know, now we're not counting holidays and things like that, but, 56 class days. And it's a 40-hour week course. You know, you're in the classroom all day long. And in addition to that, you're going home every night with 2, 3, 4 hours of homework. And the homework might not be your traditional, you're studying from a book. But you're more trying to find your rhythm, trying to get comfortable with actually speaking to someone about something. It's very similar to, you know, civilian type recruiting. You have to become a subject matter expert and a salesman on the military. And you put a lot of time and effort into it. It's a gentleman's course for sure, but there's so much that goes into it.
I'm still reeling on what you said about a 60-day course, 8-hour classes, and I'm wondering for the recruiters that are listening, do they go through such an intensive training when they became recruiting? Because most people that I know, they sort of fall into recruiting. You know, they don't really take a 60-day course that's 8 hours long each day with tons of homework. So that's really amazing to me just to hear that bit.
Oh, absolutely. Aside from the military folks that I've worked with in the past, Air Force, Marine Corps, Navy, I don't recall recruiting being on the curriculum anywhere, you know, outside of the military.
Well, and the thing is about it, Jim, and I mean, you are in the military, so skipping class, that's not an option. So, you mean, you're going to have attendance, you're going to be there, you know, and again, as I think, I don't know if Dennis said it or not, you are actually, in most cases, hand-selected by the Department of the Army to be pushed into this position. So they're not just taking all comers. In most cases, you are actually what they call DA selected, and kind of like what they do with drill sergeants and obviously recruiters. So this is, I mean, they're trying to take the cream of the crop and put them into school so that they can get the right product on the other end.
Wow. That's something else that's enlightening, because like I said before, a lot of recruiters just sort of fall into it. It's not like a cream of the crop kind of situation, which is why I think so many recruiters have a bad reputation out there in the marketplace. You were saying,
absolutely.
Dennis? I'm sorry.
To kind of elaborate on what Chad's talking about. Yes, a lot of people are DA selected, or as we in the Army like to call it, DA volunteered, where the Army volunteers you for one of these schools like drill sergeant school or recruiting school. I happen to be one of those folks that actually volunteered myself.
Okay.
I went to Army recruiting school when I was 20 years old, and I've always been a people person. So I knew it was something that I would excel in. I don't have a problem speaking with people, especially if it's something that I'm passionate about. And the military was something I was very passionate about at that time in my life. And a lot of the folks that you would be recruiting for the military, they're just coming out of high school. They're just starting college. So I was still in that age range where I could relate to them and they could relate to me. So I was in Michigan, Bay City, Michigan, which at the time I was in the number one station, the number one recruiting station, and the number one recruiting company, and the number one recruiting battalion, and the number one recruiting brigade. So there was really no room for failure. No pressure, right? I was the youngest recruiter out of 500 in the state.
Wow.
And I was the only person on this special, it was called the Corporal Recruiting Program, where they took junior non-commissioned officers and let them become recruiters.
And so what are some of the things you would learn in the military recruiting school that would be of interest, you think, to corporate recruiters or agency recruiters who would say, wow, we don't do that, or I haven't considered that before, that kind of thing?
Well, a big part of the school, and this goes along with civilian recruiting as well, is overcoming objections. Now, I'm currently working on the Honeywell accounts, and if you call someone and you say, listen, I have this mechanical engineering role that I want to talk to you about, it's for Honeywell, they're like, no way. You know, you don't get threatened. You don't get there's not a negative stigma with it.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, a lot of the military has negative stigma around it. Something happened to someone's friend's brother, 20 years ago. So you really learn how to overcome objections and really drill down to find folks' dominant buying motive. You know, what is it that you're really looking to do with your life, with your career? Once you graduate high school, once you graduate college, where do you see yourself? And it's about building rapport, building relationships. And so many of these things correspond with what we do on the civilian side. So there's definitely a lot of transferable skills.
You think about it, though, Jim. I mean, you're not just trying to gain rapport with the candidate, because in some cases, in most cases,
you can say most
looking,
in this scenario.
You're looking, your candidates are just coming out of high school, or they're, you know, in their early 20s, and their mom, their dad, their family actually has, they're decision makers, not just influencers, but decision makers on this. So you don't just have to sell the candidates. you have to go through the process of really selling the entire family unit itself. It's above and beyond what recruiters today really have to do in most cases.
Sure. Now, I imagine, too, that you have to deal with people may have a different, how can I say this, a political viewpoint about military. So I'm sure they may have their certain biases. I know some people, from what I've read online and in different newspaper articles, there are some people who just hate military recruiters because they hate the idea of the military for whatever reason. How do you deal with those kind of folks? How do you deal with those kind of objections?
You thank them, thank you, and then you move on. It's like if you went to someone and you're talking about God or Jesus or a church to them, and they're like, whoa, hold on, I'm atheist.
Mm-hmm.
You don't try and push your views on them. It's like if you're trying to sell someone something and you see they're not buying, you cut your losses and you move on. But you leave on a high note. You leave on a good note with them. Thank you. You're not pushy, and you move on. The last thing that you want to do is create a bad name for yourself and the community that you're within. Because once you go to a recruiting station, you're there for at least 3 years. So the last thing that you want to do is tarnish your name, your reputation, and give your service a bad name.
Mm.
So
you're talking about a local town, or I mean, you're actually talking about a community, not like the community that we say with respect to recruiters, where the recruiting community is, all over the world. We're talking about locally. You have to infuse yourself in the community and be a part of that community. So just what Dennis is saying, I mean, it's more necessary for a military recruiter to be infused in that community than we have to really think about in today's world.
So I'm sorry?
No, you go ahead.
To elaborate more on what Chad is saying, when you enter into these communities, it's not like you're going to New York City where there's millions of people. I was in a location where there were two small high schools that together didn't have the size of the graduating class that I graduated, high school from. It's very small towns, and you want to get involved in your community. On Saturdays and Sundays, you would find us at the Boys and Girls Clubs helping out. We'd be volunteering for different events throughout the town, having lunch with the mayor, participating in the Chamber of Commerce. You want to get as involved and integrated into your community as possible. So when John Smith's son graduates high school and he doesn't know what he's going to do, he says, this person's been serving on our Chamber of Commerce, or he's been helping out with this event or this event. Why don't you go talk to him? You want to build such a reputation and rapport with your community that people feel comfortable coming to speak with you.
Wow.
It's so much about building rapport and relationships, even more so than we do in recruiting. Now, I mean, obviously you want to build rapport and build relationships, and you want people to trust in you and in what you're doing with them, because they're putting their trust and their livelihood in your hands and hoping that this position that you're talking about with them, this mechanical engineer position or this analyst position, is what it's cracked up to be. But they're not signing a 2-3-4-6-year agreement with you, with the government. So you have to really build that reputation and build that trust within your community, within your schools, within these families, the brothers, sisters, girlfriends, boyfriends, husbands, wives, and parents. Very important.
Wow. If I hear that, it sounds like what you're doing is more of a calling than a job, which is to a lot of recruiters that I've spoken with as I've traveled around, they see it more as a job than a calling. Because I know a lot of recruiters out there, they will post a job and pray somebody will respond, and they may email someone, but they're sort of afraid to pick up the phone and talk. And I hear the exact opposite listening to you.
It wasn't It wasn't always like that. It's, as soon as you hit your first recruiting station, and now keep in mind, I graduated top of my class. I killed it in school, but that wasn't real. You know, I'm interviewing another recruiter sitting next to me for my final, you know, trying to sell him on the military, trying to get him to join the Army.
Mm-hmm.
Once you actually get out there in the real world and you're picking up these high school lists and you're just calling random kids, never was a 17-year-old intimidating to me until that time.
Huh.
And I, you know, and this was a time really before caller ID and caller call blocking.
Mm-hmm.
So these folks are, there may have been, there was caller ID back then. I apologize. This, we're looking at like 2000, but it would come up as U.S. government. So people get nervous. Like, who in the world from the U.S. government's calling me? What did I do?
Right.
So they answer the phone and, you know, hey, this is Corporal Carpenter with the United States Army Recruiting. Is so-and-so there? And they're like, no. And then they hang up on you and you're like, oh, you know, so it takes the wind out of your sails. And you have to go through so many bad phone calls before you actually get someone that's willing to talk to you. It's a lot like what we do now.
Sure.
As civilian recruiters, you have to go through several, you know, say you email blast 100 candidates. If you get 5 that respond, you're like, that's awesome. These folks are qualified because you've seen their resumes. They have the skill set you're looking for. They have the degree you're looking for, the experience. But on the military side, it's a little different because you're calling this student, you're calling this person that's in their early 20s. Like Chad said, you don't know what kind of record this person has. You don't know what they've done in the past. You don't know if they're smart enough to pass the ASVAB test, which is an aptitude test that everyone trying to get into the military must take. You don't pass this test, you can't join. And it's a skills assessment test. They could be the greatest person in the world. They're all gung-ho, ready to join. They take the ASVAB test, and they fail it. They have to wait 30 days to retake it. They fail it again, 6 months. They fail it again, they have to wait a year.
Wow.
And by the time that 6 months or year comes around, they're doing something else. They don't want to join now. It was a calling for sure, but it wasn't without its difficulty, I'll tell you that.
I imagine world events probably impacts your recruiting quotas, if you have quotas.
There are quotas. Absolutely. And it all depends on the size of your community, the size of your recruiting station. I was in a station where we had 3 recruiters and a station commander. The station commander basically was like your recruiting manager. We mm-hmm. were on mission every month for 10. That's 7 folks that got 100 or better on the ASVAB test. They passed, they're a graduate, and they're good to go. You have to get 7 people a month to pass this difficult test. And then in addition to that, this is just for the regular Army now, and in addition to that, we had to get an additional 3 people to pass the ASVAB test that wanted to join the reserves.
Wow.
Yeah. And then you have something like 9/11 that I was a recruiter during that time, and it really brought out camaraderie. It brought out people loving America again. You know, I remember mm-hmm. driving down the street a couple days before that, and this person has a flag hanging from their house, and so does this guy down the street. September 11th hit the next week. It was like I was driving through a parade. You know, there's flag everywhere. The flag company must have been doing real good about that time. Mm-hmm. But there was just all this camaraderie, and people really wanted to join. I remember being in my office, and this gentleman was in his 50s. He came walking in. He's like, I'm ready to go. And I said, sir, you know, I appreciate that. I really do. But, you know, maybe go down to your local VFW or American Legion, buy everybody a beer. You know, go buy a flag, wave it. You know, unfortunately, there's not much we can do for you. Because if you had never been in the military before, the cutoff age is 34 years old and the day before your 35th birthday. So there wasn't a lot we could do. And then the other folks that were within the age range that walked in, they're like, I want to go over there and, you know, using expletives and whatnot. They couldn't pass the test. Or they had just a fury of felonies in their background. And, you know, maybe these are the folks that we want to send over there to do some damage. But unfortunately, there wasn't a lot we could do. Now, we did see an increase in recruiting during that time. We were having record-breaking months, you know, for the rest of 2001 and into 2002. And then you see it start to die off and go back to the way it was. But that world events do bring out the camaraderie. It brings out just the love for the United States again. As Chad likes to say, a lot of people are interested, but not committed.
Ah. That's deep. Let's put it on a bumper sticker there, Chad.
You know what? They're interested.
I've got that one trademarked, man.
Yeah. You know what? They're interested in the military, and a lot of these, you know, like a lot of these companies that Chad and I are working with and talking to, they say that they're veteran friendly. People will come up and they'll thank you for your service. They'll see you in uniform. Thank you for your service. Appreciate all you do. And then you ask them, yo, is anyone in your household of age to join the military? Whoa, hold on. Not my son. Well, why not? Why not? No, he's not getting killed. You know, what people don't realize is there are so many MOSs or military occupational specialties or jobs that people can get into that you're not infantry. You're not out there on the front lines. I'm using finger quotes right now that you can't see, but you're not out there doing that. You know, there's
What percentage would you say are like non-combat jobs? Just like ballpark.
You're looking at two-thirds. Yeah. Anywhere for you, about two-thirds, if not more, you know.
Are non-combat?
Most of the military is support in nature. Mm-hmm. Because we don't just go to fight wars, where we also have peacekeeping missions. If you think about it, you know, who did we send for Hurricane Katrina, and who do we send mm-hmm. here locally when we need forces? We send the National Guard. We don't just have infantry. I was a part of the infantry, but that's actually a much smaller size of a force than the military is overall, which is another big piece is that, you know, as Dennis recruits, you know, and that's what many, many people think out there is that, well, they're just recruiting for soldiers that are going to war. Well, yeah, but there are different aspects of war and peacetime operations. And we're talking about mechanics. We're talking about rocket scientists. I mean, you take a look at the Air Force. They put more rockets into space than NASA does. You take a look at the Navy and their nuclear programs, things of that nature. So, you know, top down technology, and then also the skilled trades. You've got everything. Pretty much in the military that you do on the outside. And again, it is more support intensive than it is combat intensive.
I imagine there's a big push for cybersecurity these days in the military.
The Air Force has a huge, as a matter of fact, I think I would say probably the best cybersecurity jobs in the world. And I would say that when they come out, they probably have jobs waiting for them just about on the cybersecurity side.
Absolutely. You know, and to delve even deeper into that, the 1st and the 15th of every month, you get paid. There are finance people that have to make sure that happens. There is HR departments. There are admin assistants. You know, there's so many HR and finance type roles within the military that people don't think of. They just think, you know, camo on your face and you're out there with your rifle and your flak vest on, you know, taking fire. But no, the military is like any other, you know, Fortune 500 or Fortune 100 company, and you have all of these departments that comprise the company as a whole. And people,
well, now the big difference there, though, is in Fortune 500 companies, when the proverbial you-know-what hits the fan, your finance director is not going to pick up a weapon and be able to fire it. In the military, that finance director can pick up the weapon. You know, that cook, that it doesn't matter. Every single, I mean, there's a warrior ethos that that is instilled in us. And that's one thing that, you know, I believe is really needed in many organizations. Not that they can pick up a weapon and they can fire it, but the what we call Army Corps values, where we focus on leadership, duty, respect, selfless service, honor, you know,
integrity.
Integrity, personal courage. I mean, and the list goes on. These are core values that we focus on day in and day out. And to be able to pull those types of individuals into your organization who are incredibly flexible, because once again, when you're in the military, everybody sees this hierarchy and they see this rigidness. The interesting part about that is the rigidness of the hierarchy is even just as flexible, because we have to be able to have the autonomy to achieve the mission in the way that we see fit. So, you know, the mission comes down from HQ. We're given the mission. We're not told line by line how to achieve the mission. We are given objectives. We go after and are provided with the autonomy on how to take care of those objectives, which means we develop solution-oriented individuals. That's what our focus is. In basic training as a drill sergeant, I didn't tell, I didn't instruct them on how to specifically go after achieving the task. I gave them the tools, and then I asked them and I challenged them to go after and find their solution. That's how basic training is done today versus back in the Soviet days when we all used to just line up in wedges and walk through the forest.
Now, you're hitting on a bunch of intangibles that I think companies would love to have in their employees, and obviously the military has a lot of skills. So when you say like two-thirds of all the jobs there are non-combat. So I'm really curious about something. I'm going to get both of you guys' take on this as the time sort of creeps up on us. Why do you think companies are not more engaged in hiring veterans? I mean, I know they may say they're veteran friendly, but what does that really mean? Because I've seen different news reports and I've read this several times about how veterans are having, a difficult time,
right.
A difficult time trying to get hired. But it's really baffling to me because they have so much of the skills and so much of the intangible skills that companies crave. I don't get what the issue is there.
Well, companies, in most cases, they don't know what they don't know, and that's scary. What they do need to know is there are actually blueprints out there on how to do this. I mean, my job every single day is to build these types of programs, and to be quite frank, it's simple. If you're going to work on the car, you have to have the right tools, right? You can't just go in there with your bare hands and go after it. You can, but you're not going to fix the car. In this case, you have to have the right tools, which means you have to have somebody with military background and veteran hiring experience to be able to lead the charge and build a team to focus on being able to identify what your company's real needs are. And most companies, they don't even understand that. The translation piece, they think, is all on the candidate side, which really, they need to self-assess before they start profiling candidates. They need to know what they're really looking for. When you start talking about this, the character, the attributes, those types of things. In most cases, I mean, that's not a part of the job description. So they need to know what they're looking for so that they can appropriately profile candidates. Once they can understand if this is going to be a lower level NCO, if it's going to be lower level enlisted, it's going to be senior NCO, or maybe it might be a junior military officer. As soon as you know that type of individual and you know what they did in the military, possibly their occupation in the military, then you can at that point you can start targeting partners and building networks. Because at that point, you know what you're looking for. The thing is, you need help to be able to pull those candidates in. So, you know, it sounds hard. And to be quite frank, for a layman, for somebody who hasn't been in, for somebody who doesn't have talent acquisition and veteran programs experience, it is hard. But you get the right tool, you get the right person in the organization, you build a team around them that are dedicated to veteran hiring, and it becomes much, much easier.
Dennis, you want to add to that?
Anything
along? Okay, go ahead.
When recruiters see resumes from military folks, and I'm not saying that the military folks have the best resumes in the world, but you need someone that understands how to read between the lines. Let's say this gentleman gets out of the military with 8 years of experience. He was an E6 in the Army, a staff sergeant, you know, a non-commissioned officer in the Army, but he was infantry. Someone sees that resume and thinks, all right, this person could be a police officer. They could be a bouncer. They could be security guard. Yeah. But what they're not seeing, and again, they don't know what they don't know, are all the attributes that come with being a non-commissioned officer: leadership, ability to teach others, you're writing counseling statements monthly on your troops. You know, there's so much that goes into being a non-commissioned officer or being an officer that the general public is not made aware of. They don't know what they don't know. And these are the things that we need to get out there to the public, because this E6, you know, staff sergeant, you know, former infantry soldier could be the next manager, could be the next frontline supervisor. There's so many things that this person is qualified for, but people just see it, you know, in black and white. This person was infantry. We don't have any bouncer slots available right now. We don't need another security guard. People need to know how to delve deeper into their skill set, and they don't.
Well, hopefully after listening to this podcast, they'll have their eyes open, and we'll see more military hiring going on. Chess Sawash, Dennis Carpenter, thank you so much for being in the It's All Recruiting podcast.
Thank you, Mr. Stroud.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for listening. If you were not there, then I would be here talking to myself. So thank you for that. If you would, check out the links in the podcast description, because they are there for you. Finally, if you love what you heard, hate what you heard, or not quite sure what you just heard, I want to know about it. Connect with me on Twitter at Jim Stroud, or LinkedIn, or Google+, or pretty much anywhere you find me online. I'm everywhere. Okay, enough of that. Until next time, one last word spoken 3 times to my people at Randstad Sourceright. Love, love, love.